Hey, everybody. Welcome to today's OIG Roundtable. Today, we're the OIG TV tray because Wade is out on one of our contracts doing some work. Or it could also be early spring in Wisconsin, and that means he's mowing the lawn. One of the two. We're not sure.
Or shoveling snow or both.
Or shoveling and then mowing. But either way, I've got Christopher Walken's doppelganger. Matt Kachansky, the retired special agent in charge from the OIG. Oh yeah, well that too. You could be David Byrne's doppelganger. You could be David Byrne, David or Byrne Christopher Walken.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dazed and confused. But the days gone by. What are these more cowbell? So Matt, it's good to see you. So we want to talk. There's the press releases have been hot and heavy, and I was all prepared to talk about a bunch of other things, and then I got my alert that I get, and it looks like the strike force, it's tough to tell from some of these press releases, but it looks like the strike force may now be rolled in under this new national fraud division that is within DOJ, because there was a press release that was put out the other day. $552 million in fraud for genetic testing. And it's pretty, it really is the playbook. This was a West Coast case, and this is hitting the playbook, but $522 million. I'm just looking at the presser right now. There's about a dozen defendants in this case. They clearly worked their way up. They had telemarketers. They had some marketers who got some de minimis amounts of time. I was really surprised one of the doctors who was implicated only got 12 months. Who, you know, to me, regardless of who the owners of the business are, the doctors are the ones that are signing those orders. They're the tip of the spear. At the end of the day, it amazes me how the doctors are treated differently than the owners of these bogus companies, whether it be a telemarketing company, whether it be the genetic testing, a lab, a DME company. It is always amazing to me that the doctors are sometimes treated in some different category. And we can have conversations ad nauseum about how healthcare professionals that are involved in fraud, waste, and abuse and get prosecuted or have a civil case against them are treated oftentimes with a different lens, however that may be. But I was amazed at how, in this case, one of the doctors here's one. A doctor by the name of, his name is Nelson Giraldo, a medical doctor, 6 months of house arrest and 3 years of probation. A nurse practitioner, 24 months. Another nurse practitioner, 21 months. A doctor, 12 months. Another doctor, 12 months. But you've got marketers getting 46 months, you know, different ranges. And we could have an entirely separate conversation about what they call the 3553 factors, which is for deterrence. We could talk about, you know, the fact that the whole point of incarceration has to do with deterrence and punitiveness and the punitive nature of it, and what have you. But it is what it is. $552 million. When I read this press release, it immediately reminded me of the case that I worked at OIG involving an individual named Seth Riefus and his entirely bogus charity called Good Samaritans of America. I know when I've talked about these cases before, I brought this up. It was the first genetic testing case. I don't know if it was in the country, but certainly in New Jersey. Seth Riefus was going into senior citizen buildings, and he was doing talks to senior citizens about free and low-cost services that they could get under the guise that his bogus not-for-profit, Good Samaritans of America, would help to facilitate that. But he was really nothing more at the end of the day. He started off actually as a Medicare Advantage sales rep, and that's where his fraud started, because he was doing some bogus things and moving people into Medicare Advantage plans. But then it quickly spiraled into him being a sales rep for a genetic testing company where they were doing the swabs, and he was paying kickbacks to the doctors. You know, the thing I think that people, when they look at and they see that this scheme went on for 5 or 6 years, and they look and they see $552 million. First and foremost, this guy had 3 or 4 different labs and some shell companies. He obviously had a very vast network of marketers and salespeople going to fairs. What I thought was interesting was he actually had people going door to door. So they were selling Encyclopedia Britannica and Ginsu knives vacuum cleaners and genetic tests with a swab. So it was amazing to me that that people were still answering their doors and that was going on. But obviously you've got the DNA test. First and foremost, these are expensive tests. You could be paying in excess. When I say you, I mean insurance programs, Medicare, Medicaid included, can be paying in excess of $10,000 or $12,000 for these tests. Now, for those that don't fully understand what these tests are, there are two different kinds of tests out there. One is for cancer screening. Those are known as the CGX tests. The other ones that are more commonly done in this space that we're talking about right now are really the PGX. And those tests are really done for pharmaceutical related issues where the test results will show what a particular patient's potential propensity is genetically to metabolize certain drugs. You see this pretty often when they're doing these genetic tests on statin drugs, your cholesterol reducing drugs. And to some extent, if you've been on one of these drugs for 10 or 15 or 20 years, this test is useless because you've been on the drug 15 or 20 years. The thing about this test is it is also typically a one and done test, meaning that insurance, when you get it, it's medically necessary. You get it, and then you can never get it again. The problem is that if you have been on the unfortunate victim of having this test rendered or billed to your Medicare, Medicaid, or commercial insurance account, and it's a bogus test, and you actually need this test later on, you're in a little bit of a pickle and you're not getting it. So $552 million, it is a lot of money, but understand that this is it's a fairly expensive test. And, there's nothing to it. It's what they call a buccal swab, where they go in with a kind of a piece of cotton and it gets sent to the lab and the lab does a bunch of tests on it. I don't think that these tests are all that expensive to perform. I've heard that it's only a few hundred bucks. The machine kind of does it. It's a semi-automated test, but the reimbursements are very high. But when you look at this playbook reads like every other one of these ancillary tests that involve the reps. And the big thing is this is all, so in the sense where you had a health fair, so that's a common one. These elderly people go to health fairs at the senior citizen center, and then boom, they're sitting in the chair and they're getting this free test, and they're none the wiser. The door-to-door solicitation was weird to me because you don't really see that all that much. But then obviously there's still the usual the telephonic things along those ways. Of course, the problem is you always see that there's nurse practitioners involved with this because NPs aren't paid as well as doctors, and so that's your target-rich environment. What do I have to do? I just need to sign some of these requisitions, and I'm good. No provider-patient relationship. The labs are in different places from the patients. The data is going to help show this, but the one thing that we've been saying all along is that one of the ways that these get perpetuated is the fact that there is, generally speaking in the industry, that 12-month time period to submit the claim and that 12-month period of time in which the provider has to submit the claim is where you're going to have that lag time. Now, we all know that the ordering provider is never sending in a claim for an E&M. There just isn't one. Most of the time, there isn't one because the provider isn't seeing the patient. They're not going to be at the health fair. They're not going door to door. There's nothing going on where that actually happens. And even the ones where it's through telemarketers, someone else is completing a form and the provider is just signing off on them by the dozens or whatever. So there's typically never going to be a companion E&M. But certainly if you tightened up the time periods, or more importantly, my opinion is if you're getting claims for what are known as these high risk codes, such as genetic testing, a lot of these ancillary services and some of the high-risk DME space, things of that sort, like, why aren't these claims just being put into a separate category? Just because they're high risk, let's throw them into some category. But it certainly begs the question, Matt, and I want to pick your brain from the UPIC perspective, because I know when you were running the UPIC, that was during the time period of Operation Brace Yourself and some of the, like, Operation Double Helix and some of these other named cases that are out there. But they all kind of fit. Again, it's like, the circus tent is the same. It's who's the clown in charge, right? There's this rotation of people, but the playbook is the same. And the fraud schemes are always the same. And yet it's like, do we ever just learn our lesson from the, you know, this is the upteenth hundredth case like this. And if you looked at DME, if you looked at genetic testing, if you looked at, you know, a bunch of other things in the space, ancillary services, this is the same kind of playbook.
And sometimes it's even the same players. You know, we had a lot of cases under Operation Brace Yourself on, you know, DME companies where it was the pattern of there was no history between the ordering physician or provider and the patient that was receiving the mummy kit of braces that they were receiving, sometimes from multiple companies. And the same was true of, you know, the genetic drug testing, where there was the same pattern of no history between the doctor and the patient, or the provider and the patient that ordered the test and the patient. What we came to find out is sometimes it was the same ordering provider and the same patient getting both. We were doing on-site interviews of some of the Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries and recipients under Operation Brace Yourself. We were, you know, taking pictures of all the equipment that they were receiving that was still in the boxes, getting statements from them. And, you know, while we were sitting there in these folks' homes, they were getting 2, 3, 5 phone calls while we were in there for an hour, all of them from these types of marketers, you know, including, you know, ones for genetic testing. So it was coming right on the heels of Operation Brace Yourself, where these marketers now selling genetic testing. You know, send us your swab. Do you feel like you can possibly get cancer? Please send us a swab and we can, you know, take that fear away from you, that type of thing. And it was just frightening that, you know, once these people gave their, you know, their Medicare number, you know, whether it's at a health fair or whether it was at a community center where someone was coming around giving a presentation on something, and they, you know, they're asked for their health insurance information, and they just unknowingly gave it.
Yeah.
They were open to just rampant, you know, unmitigated fraud on the parts of these companies. And what the really frustrating thing was for us as a UPIC and as for, you know, SIUs, there was nothing we could do about the ordering providers.
Right.
They didn't bill. There was no hook to take care of them administratively.
And that's the challenge. So, you know, one of the things that I remember when I was working on the case with Seth Riefus with genetic testing, he used scare tactics. So he would go to the senior buildings and he would say, hey, look, you've all watched the commercials on TV about adverse effects. And while for 95% of you, there's going to be no problem, 5% of you might have a problem. How many of you are grandparents? How many of you want to make sure you're alive to see your grandchildren grow up? We would never want you to have an adverse event on this, right? And so that kind of sets that perpetuation. The other thing that becomes an issue when you're doing this over the telephone to get these people to opt in, to get the kits or whatever, or even in the in-person ones at these health fairs, is they would say, we're working with your doctor. And I remember when we were doing a bunch of these cases involving mail order diabetic testing supplies and lidocaine. So when the compounding started to go away and they started to switch to the 5% lidocaine, so 4% you could buy over the counter, 5% is a prescription. 4% over the counter is about $8. 5% prescription, substantially more. Same thing with what's known as diclofenac sodium. Most people know it as Voltaren. It is now over the counter. You can get Voltaren gel. It was the same thing when it was as a prescription, where they would say, the marketers would say, we're working with your doctor. And the same thing, you'd go to someone's house and they would go and they would take out a box that would have 30 tubes of lidocaine or whatever medicine of the day it is. And it would have the doctor's name on it. And I said, well, do you know this doctor? No, but I assumed that they were working with my doctor because I have arthritis on the knee and the prescription says for arthritis on the knee. And I would assume that I would be that. But that is the challenge. Now, in the instance where, you know, here, the providers are getting a kickback. The docs, the nurse practitioners are being paid basically a clicking fee, right? They're being paid $25, $30, whatever it may be, for each prescription that they sign, every order they sign, they're getting a kickback of a certain amount. And so while there may be some challenges in being able to do anything with those providers, the way that you have to go after them is a violation of the anti-kickback statute. And for the commercial side, U.S. attorney's offices have gotten very good at using the Travel Act. We use that in District of New Jersey. Very first time it was ever used was in a case known as Biodiagnostic Labs, BLS, at the time was the largest kickback case in the country, where they were getting kickbacks for not only government but commercial pay, and the commercial pay was pretty substantial. And so they used something called the Travel Act, which is a prohibition era statute, but it certainly fit because you're affecting interstate commerce, and they came up with some novel ways to do it. But that becomes the challenge. Like, what do you do at the onset to the providers from an SIU UPIC perspective? Because it really is a scourge. You've got $552 million. I'm still amazed that we sit here today and we're still having conversations about something that I worked on 2015 to 2016 or 17, that we're still talking about the same types of fraud schemes. And then even, you know, more modern, now they've moved on to, right, it's still the DME, it's still the mail order prescriptions, it's still this. And the data in this case, I'm going to guess the data was a little truncated because there were four different labs. But the question still becomes, if you're working on these cases, and you're suddenly seeing, for example, either the doctors or the nurse practitioners, did they go from all of a sudden not being the ordering provider to being the ordering provider? Like, were genetic tests not important to them, and then all of a sudden they became important to them, right? That's a really good data element. How does something that a provider never billed for or never ordered, because you could be an ordering doctor and not, in this case, they're not billing for it. How do you go from never ordering a test to, in some instance, ordering it a lot? And then you look at the data and you see, wait a minute, this nurse practitioner, this doctor, they've never even seen this patient. There isn't even an E&M there.
And all of them are going to the same lab or group of labs if they're, you know, co-owned by somebody. It's the patterns are there in the data. It's just, you've got to just search it out a little bit. One of the other frustrations we had was, you know, working with CMS, and this is where, you know, SIU plans can maybe have a little more impact. You know, we tried to get CMS to, you know, suspend or put a prepay on any type of DME or genetic test that was being ordered by someone that had no history with. But they went back to that, it takes a year to submit the claim. We don't know if they've ever been seen before. And we're like, 99% of the time, these patients have never seen this doctor, and they're not going to complain. And they're just, you know, access to care is not an issue here.
But part of this also, Matt, is that the ordering provider, forget that 12-month period and having to wait, but you're seeing the patient in one part of the country, you're seeing the ordering provider in another part of the country, and the lab is in another part of the country. So it's like, it doesn't take a really sharp investigator very much time to realize, hey, there's something is not right here. And if if there's no history with this provider, then what gives the provider the requisite information to be able to even know that they need to do this? It would, remember, these genetic tests are typically in response to what the course of action should be. Hey, Mr. Kachansky, I want to put you on a statin because you have high cholesterol. But before I do that, let's run this genetic test to see how your body will react to it. Not, hey, Mr. Kachansky, I know you've been on a statin for 20 years. Let's do this test, right? I mean, there's got to be, your history will show that. But, you know, it's on the first visit, it's like, whoa, what's going on here? Particularly if these are in some regards a telemedicine visit. Because let's say they are doing this under the guise of a telemedicine screening. What information would a provider need to have to think that they need to do the genetic test for Makhachansky? Well, first of all, probably some historical blood results.
Blood test, yeah.
Or urine tests, right? So the question then becomes, collaterally, has there been an order, has there been a claim from a lab for blood or urine tests within 60 days of the genetic test? Because that's going to be your workaround for anything involving the doctor. Because these genetic tests should be an overlap, right? Your right. Venn diagram, blood test, genetic test, problem.
Yep. Yes.
And that should be your workaround. Your workaround should be that when you get a claim for a genetic test for a patient, regardless of who the ordering doctor is there within 60 or 90 days, has there been a claim from a lab, same lab or different lab, but has there been a claim from a laboratory for some diagnostic related service for which the genetic testing would make sense? And I think that's where we need to go when we're looking at the data. That's kind of the next iteration. From the data perspective, we should be looking at a matchup of claims to see, hey, we just got a claim for a genetic test from this lab. Has there been an or has there been a claim submitted for some diagnostic related lab test that's blood or urine based for this?
Yeah, because they have to be part of the course of treatment or history of the patient to be covered, to be medically necessary, or else they're just what they right. are, which is just a profit mode.
And in the same vein, if we're talking about the CGX testing, which is the cancer testing, is there a prior, first of all, is there a prior diagnosis of cancer for the patient? And oftentimes it won't be, because most of the time you see a lot of these tests are for the BRCA2, for breast cancer. So then the question becomes, does this patient have a family history? Can we get medical records from their actual doctor to see that? But, you know, where we see a lot of these tests really is in the, a lot of it is in the PGX space, which is the metabolism of medication. But certainly I would think that in the absence of me waiting for a claim for an E&M, from that ordering doctor, which is never going to happen, the question is going to be, is there a collateral ancillary test from a lab that can stop this?
What led to the need for the test?
Right. So Matt, as we kind of wrap up our commiseration of this, because it really does get frustrating that this continues to happen and we really haven't quite come to a great solution, although I think you and I just solutioned it pretty well. But where do you go with these cases? I mean, that's the problem, is that from the kickback perspective, there's really nowhere to go. So now you have to start thinking about novel approaches. And do you start looking at other ways within the data to come up with those novel approaches and, you know, start doing like some more targeted, these are expensive tests. So do you shut down providers sooner than later? You get claims in, do you have an edit in place that says, hey, we just got a claim for a genetic test and the ordering provider is Dr. Smith, and we've never gotten a claim from Dr. Smith for Makhachansky?
If it were me, you know, all of those claims would be suspended pending the medical records coming in from Dr. Smith for the reason for the test. You get the records from the lab, you get the records from the ordering provider, and short of that, these types of tests should not be paid.
Now, the challenge is obviously, with doing these investigations, one of the challenges is that the CMS regulations regarding documentation for ancillary services, the lab is really only going to have a super limited amount of information. The lab that's doing the test is going to have an order
and
the sample
and the test result. Yeah.
And the test results. However, the regulations do say that while the lab may not be required to maintain copies of the records, they must have access to the records or be able to obtain those records.
Correct. Yeah, it is their responsibility to provide the records to those that request
right.
them.
So the first question is, from a laboratory genetic testing ancillary service perspective, should labs be updating compliance policies to say when ordering, when receiving an order for a genetic test, an accompanying E&M should be there, or supporting documentation so that you're not having to hunt it down? Should you know, ultimately, should OIG or CMS, should there be a tectonic shift in the methodology for guiding providers of these services? Like, should there be a position paper that says that or should the policy be changed to say that it is incumbent upon the lab to have copies of those records, not just that they're available? Because at the end of the day, that's what's going to happen. The lab is going to submit what they're going to need to submit. And what they're going to submit is an order. We see this a lot in the pharmacy space, right? This, under state laws, pharmacists have a duty to fill. You present what appears to be a valid prescription, you have a duty to fill. And if you don't fill it, you could potentially be running afoul of state law. But if you fill it, you could be running afoul of federal, like, narcotics laws or whatever, if it's an opioid or something. So it's kind of a slippery slope.
Yeah, to try to get the labs to maintain the medical records in support of every test they receive, I think that's going to be tough. Maybe there should be a subset of those types of tests that they have to maintain the records for, some, like genetic tests, some of the more expensive HIV or hepatitis tests that they need to keep the records for in support of the test that's being done.
Right. I mean, it almost makes sense. If I'm going to be receiving the order to do the genetic test from someone, that the medical records, this is legitimate. In a legitimate world, in a legitimate world, when the provider sends the order for the genetic test to the lab, in a legitimate world, they would have the medical records and say, attached, please find these. Because right. In some instances, the genetic testing is done in the office. They're doing the swabbing in the doctor's office and then sending the sample in a bag with the requisition.
Right.
It really wouldn't be very much for them to also just push the print button for the order, and then the lab has the order. They have, you know, they have all of that, because we know from working these cases that in most instances, because it's tainted by a kickback, it's all fraudulent, it's teledoc with nothing, there is no medical record. Right. Or the medical record is a substandard document that's nothing but a check sheet. So does that maybe become something from, even if it's CMS that's not doing it, that from the plan side, if you're going to pay for certain things, that you have to have some of this accompanying information. Look, we know in the DME space, a lot of DME, in order for DME to be ordered, there has to be proof of a face-to-face, right? We know that that's the case in a lot of DME, and we know that that doesn't happen. And so it doesn't happen, and we don't know it doesn't happen until that 12-month period has expired, and lo and behold, we have a fraud because there was no documentation of at the minimum of a claim to show that face-to-face.
Yeah. Pre-authorizations is another way, you know, for certain tests that they need to get them pre-authorized and then, you know, provide the support for the need for the test. That's another way.
Now, by the way, I just read something the other day that United apparently, I may be making this up, but I thought the article I read a few days ago, and I don't remember fully, but I thought the article talked about United was removing pre-authorization, something like 30% of things that were required for pre-authorization. But there was a change on the United side regarding pre-authorization for certain things. And those that work in the CM in the Medicare space know there isn't a lot of pre-authorization in the Medicare space. We know that there's been some pilots on pre-auth. I mean, I think one of the most successful pilots that became an actual program is the pre-authorization for non-emergency routine ambulance transports. We saw that they did that as a pilot in like 5 states, and there was a humongous reduction in the cost for non-emergency routine transports, because a lot of those people could have gone by wheelchair, they could have gone by livery, they could have gone by other means. And some of those means would have been cost absorbed by, for example, the nursing home as part of the DRG, the per diem that's paid for things like that. You know, keeping in mind that when a patient goes, I don't want to get too much off topic, but when a patient's in a nursing home and they need dialysis 3 times a week, if they're going by stretcher, that becomes something that is outside of the SNFs per diem, and it's individually reimbursed by the ambulance transport company under Part B. If the person is going typically three times a week and is going by wheelchair or something else, that's a cost that has to be absorbed by the nursing home. So mm-hmm. there's a way to offset that cost and kind of get some preferred pricing on those kinds of cases. But, you know, certainly we're seeing so many of these genetic testing cases and so many of the resurgence of the DME frauds and so much of the still the mail order frauds and these other things. And no matter how vigilant the Medicare population wants to continue to try to be, this is all, it's all still going on. So there certainly need to be some steps that plans need to take, and whether it be putting pre-authorization on something like this. And always remember, I think the thing that people get confused about is pre-authorization is not a guarantee of payment. Pre-authorization is a acknowledgement that the item, service, or procedure that you're looking to get done on your patient is a covered item, service, or procedure if done properly and if documented properly. It's not a promise. Yep. It's not a promise for payment. So as we wrap up, Matt, what are your hints, tips, and tricks? I know we talked a lot about them, but part of it, I think, is that these are cases where the level of frustration could be very high. Plans could put their arms up and say, we really don't have the ability to do these cases because they are all tainted by a kickback. But, you know, there are things out there.
Yeah, the patterns in the billing are out there. There are weapons you can use. There's tools you can use. And, you know, going back to our, you know, the old sermon we're giving, you know, have a law enforcement liaison who can present these cases and, you know, and get them adjudicated quicker or accepted quicker. And you might not be on the victim list to get the money back right away, but at least you would have been able to stop the bleeding.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, at the end of the day, you've got to have data analytics that are capturing some of these weird outliers. You know, yeah. When you've got a doctor or a nurse that's never ordered this test before and is suddenly now ordering it, the question is why? And when all of the tests that they're ordering are going to the same or couple three labs, what's the issue? Yeah. And now you're off to the races, because now you can start making your inquiries. And, you know, I would be making an inquiry and I would be asking for copies of any medical records. You know, you find 10 people that have had this test done, and then you have 10 people that they just treat in their office. You make your request now for 20 records. 10 for the genetic and 10 for your office people. And then you find, hey, this is not a patient of ours. Right. And now you're good, because now they're going to say, this is not a patient of ours. Now you have an impetus to deny the claim from the genetic test for the genetic testing, because now you're saying, at the minimum, you're saying there is the provider, the ordering provider, has no records. So what is the genetic testing lab going to be able to produce? Nothing. Now you put the onus on the lab to get a record that you've already gotten the provider to tell you doesn't exist. So yep. Now if that record then shows up, you know now that there's a fabricated record. And we know in this case, they were fabricated records.
Yep.
So this could be a challenging case with a lot of tentacles. And this is the kind of case where, while I think on its face, it seems like a fairly straightforward kind of fraud scheme, but getting to the point of being able to prove it from an SIU perspective, for an overpayment, for a referral, whatever it may be, you really do want some of your more seasoned and experienced investigators on these cases, because they have to really be people who can fully understand kind of that 360-degree investigational view of how do you go about trying to get the documents and talking to people and what have you. I would surmise that in interviews, you're going to get a lot of information from people. They're going to talk to you about, you know, you're going to get lucky. You're going to find somebody who's been solicited door to door. You're going to find somebody who's solicited at a health fair. You're going to find someone who doesn't know who that provider is. I've never been to a nurse practitioner. There are people who just refuse to go to an NP or PA, right? They want to go to the doctor that they've been seeing for 20 years. And these names are going to be foreign to them. That's going to be a great piece of information. So I think this is a great case. It was obviously a huge case. But I think that it's a case that, while it shows itself as being simple on its face, there's a lot of behind the scenes investigative stuff that really needs to be done. So You know, I think we'll push all these cases to Wade since he wasn't here today.
Wade.
Anyway, Matt, good catching up with you. Glad to hear some of the stories and obviously your experiences at the UPIC. You know, they certainly go forward on a lot of these investigations, whether it be in the Medicaid commercial, Medicare Advantage. You know, I know we're working on a lot of these cases on our in-house teams and some of the places we're consulting on. We're seeing a lot of these cases. The genetic stuff, it still amazes me that 10 years after I worked the first one, 11 years after the first one, it's still like yesterday.
Yeah.
They just don't go away. So, well, we hope everybody got something out of this. I hope that you're not getting hammered to the tune of $552 million. I hope that there's some stuff on the horizon for CMS to tighten up some of these policies as well, so we could see a little bit less of this money going out the door. So anyway, good catching up with you as always, Matt. Everybody out there, thanks again for always participating on our weekly podcast. We get a lot of great feedback. We appreciate all the feedback we get on the podcast, our LinkedIn Lives. And again, our newsletter, get it right to your inbox. Catch these podcasts every week on Spotify, on YouTube, on the channel. Just go over to YouTube or Spotify and you can subscribe, get the weekly podcast right to your inbox through our newsletter or on the subscriptions through Spotify or through YouTube. So until next time, we'll see you at the OIG Roundtable.
Thank you, everybody.